Hello and welcome to the Open Talent Report. This is the podcast where we discuss the emerging trends in labor law, employment law, independent work, and the gig economy, which many organizations are wrestling with due to the growth of the open talent and gig economy. I'm your host, Conor Heaney. When I'm not presenting the podcast, I'm the MD at CXC Global, EMEA, which compliantly connects talent and opportunity. Hello and welcome to this week's show, where I'm delighted to welcome as our guest, Liam MacIver-Martin, who is a founder, author, speaker, event organizer, and a huge remote work advocate. I've been trying to get Liam on the show for some time, but mainly due to my diary, and I apologize, Liam, we've only been able to make it work. But Liam, it's a huge honor to have you on the show. A warm welcome to the show. How are you doing?
And thank you very much for including the MacIver in there. Very few people do it, but it's that last part of Scottish blood that's in me. My great-great-grandfather was Scottish. Actually, he went from Scotland to Trinidad, and we think it's because he killed someone in Scotland, and they had to actually, they said, like, either go to one of the colonies or you're going to go to jail. You're going to go to prison. So it was I haven't been back there. I was there once, maybe about 10 years ago, but I'd like to go back, get back to my Scottish roots. But I'm really excited about getting into the nitty gritty here, because I think we're going to have a very pragmatic conversation. And I think that remote work has to have a pragmatic perspective towards it in order for people to really understand the value of it. And this is something that I've reinforced constantly, because with Running Remote, and it was primarily a conference that's been running for the last 5 years, which is the largest conference on remote work. And specifically, we try to be able to provide people the information they need to be able to build remote unicorns. That's specifically the modus operandi of this particular conference. But there are a lot of what I like to call fundamentalist remote work advocates. Yes. That come to the conference. They're very passionate about remote work, and they kind of have blinders on towards all of the cons of remote work. And we're not necessarily looking at some of the issues that remote work has. And it does have issues. I think that on average, the advantages outweigh the disadvantages. But I hope that we can get into some of those as well, so people have a very pragmatic view and understand exactly what they're getting into.
Yeah, and that's my hope for today, Liam. I really want to shine a light on your book and the topics in your book, and really drill down into your thoughts. But I have to say, in the 60-odd episodes of the show, that's a pretty good opening. I don't think we've discussed potential murder or otherwise in the first few minutes of the show. So it's certainly going to be memorable for that reason alone, Liam. So a very warm welcome to you. So Liam, just for the benefit of our audience, Your book has recently been published, I think at the beginning of the European summer, and the book is called Running Remote. But what's your background, Liam? Because I mentioned that you've got a number of concurrent titles. What's the Liam MacIver-Martin pop quiz history?
Sure. So I'm currently in Montreal, Canada, which is French Canada. And my entrepreneurial journey started about almost 20 years ago at McGill University, which is the university that I went to school at for graduate school. I was teaching a class there, because most graduate students actually teach the first and second year classes in university. Started the class with about 300 students, ended up with less than 150, and the worst academic reviews in the history of the department. And the department had been running for over 180 years, so it was very bad. I remember walking into my supervisor's office and I said, "I don't think I'm very good at this." And he said, "No, you are not." And I said, "So what do you think I should do with my time here?" And he said, "Well, you got to get pretty good at teaching over the next 10 to 20 years if you want to do anything fun. So either figure out how to get better at teaching or figure out something else to do." 6 weeks later, I threw a master's thesis under his door. I was out into the real world. And that's actually the first online business that I built, because I recognized these 300 students, they really needed tutors. And I started tutoring students through Skype. And for those of you that are relatively new to remote work, you probably don't know Skype. That was really the tool that everyone used before Zoom. And I just recognized that I could get twice as many students in on Skype than I could if I was actually walking to them and teaching them directly. And that turned into a company that had a couple dozen tutors throughout North America and Europe, built that company up. And the bigger problem that I had inside of that was I couldn't actually equate for the amount of time measured, the amount of time billed between a tutor and a student. And so I would bill a student for 10 hours, and then the student would say, I only worked with my tutor for five. And I'd go to the tutor and say, hey, did you work with Jimmy for 5 hours or 10 hours? And he said, I billed you for 10. I worked with him for 10 hours. So I'd end up having to refund the student 5 hours and pay the tutor the full 10 hours. And that was really destroying the business. So that came about of working with my now business partner, Rob, who is also one of the co-authors for the book, Time Doctor, which is a time tracking tool specifically for remote workers. Then off of that, about 5 or 6 years into building the company, which was a SaaS business, technology business, we really had this frustrating moment where we said, well, there's a lot of lifestyle businesses that are remote, but there are very few large businesses that are remote. How do you actually build a business that's not just a $1 or $2 million business, but a $200, $300, $400 million a year business? What we call unicorns, tech unicorns, companies that have a valuation of more than $1 billion. And actually, there's a really good new term that I love even more called, I don't know if you've heard about this one, Connor, gorillas. Which yes. I think is actually the, and it was coined by my friend. I've spoken on a couple panels with him. A $1 billion valuation company that has more than $100 million in revenue and runs net profit. That is a gorilla, and that is actually the focus of what everyone should be putting their time and energy into. And the data was there's about 1,500 unicorns. And there's something like 30 gorillas, which is nuts.
I'm surprised it's that many.
Yeah, I'm blown away by this because it's really, I mean, obviously we're both in the tech industry, so it's a little bit of a different animal, but it's just kind of growth at all costs as opposed to building real businesses. So I love those gorillas. So at Running Remote, we want to build gorillas. We don't want to build unicorns. I got to start to work my new kind of language in there. And so gotcha. We've been running that conference for 5 years. Obviously, COVID threw a bit of a wrench in that. We did go virtual during that time, and that was successful. But we're really creating just this meeting space for everyone to be able to figure out how do you build a big remote company, not just a lifestyle business. And then when COVID hit, we got a lot of book offers. And so I spoke with HarperCollins. They seemed like a great company. And the book, Running Remote, I took about a year and a half to be able to write it. And effectively what it is a breakdown of me talking to all of these remote work pioneers and figuring out what they were doing that everyone else wasn't. And there's one singular thing that they're doing. And we name that in the book as asynchronous management, which is the ability to be able to communicate with people, communicate with your team members without simultaneously interacting with them at the same time. And I know that that's a little bit of a difficult concept for people to get their heads around. We're going to be able to get into that, I think, in this podcast. But that's the essence of what has really been the differentiator for the vast majority of these remote-first companies and why they've been able to scale to such high levels over the last couple decades.
And Liam, I've read the book, and I have to say it's a great, great read. And I think the courage, the discipline it takes to write a book is huge. You know, there's this phrase, discipline equals freedom, but I'd say you had to be extremely disciplined when it came to writing the book. Was it a difficult endeavor to sit down and actually write a book over the course of a year and a half was simultaneously running multiple businesses?
It was, definitely. However, one of the core tenets inside of the book, which we've touched on a couple times, is inside of the companies that I work on, we have this perspective, which is you should never own a position. You should currently inhabit a position. So to say, I am the CMO of the company is very different from saying I'm currently inhabiting the seat of CMO of the company. And it's a little bit of a shift in thinking, but effectively what that means is at any point, I could completely delegate that responsibility to my direct reports and therefore allow for me to leave and work on a book for a year and a half if I really wanted to. Now, I didn't completely leave. I invested about 10 to 20 hours per week for about a year and a half into writing the book in collaboration with a team as well. But it is definitely one of those things that I will almost never do again, unless someone literally comes to my house with a dump truck full of money. I will never write a book ever again because it is so incredibly difficult, particularly for someone who isn't a writer. One of my, I have a really good copy editor, Daniel, that worked with me throughout the entire book. And I was working on this one paragraph, and because we work asynchronously, we don't communicate that often, but he can see what I'm interacting with different components of the Google Doc that we were working on, because we were using Google Sheets and Google Docs to be able to to work on the book. And so he sees me working on this one particular paragraph, and it was the concept of the platform being the manager, which is what remote companies do. I mean, we can get into that later on if you want. And so I'm trying to describe this problem, and I spent about 5 hours working on it. And he said, I know that you don't want to meet with me on Zoom, but let's just jump on a call here because it looks like you're having a lot of difficulty with this spot. And within about 10 minutes, he recognized in my description, he said, oh, well, you mean the platform's the manager? And I was like, exactly. And he said, listen, in the future, just write it out and let me go back over it so that I can really kind of use what I'm good at, which is being a writer, to be able to work that out. So yeah, definitely difficult, and very difficult for someone who isn't a natural born writer.
Gotcha. Well, as I say, Liam, it's tremendously enjoyable, and I highly recommend it to your audience as well. If you're embarking on a remote work journey, you're in the middle of it, you're confused, you don't know what way to go, I think it's a great tool and a great read, so I highly recommend it. So, Liam, let's get to the nub of the room in relation to remote working. What are the macro trends that you're seeing in your organization running remote? And what are the macro trends that you've seen from writing the book that you'd care to comment on?
Sure. So I think we're at a really interesting time right now with regards to remote work. Just to kind of set the scene, February of 2020, 4% of the U.S. workforce was working remotely. And by March, that was 45%. So we're talking exponential growth within 1 month. That's the biggest transition in work since the Industrial Revolution. But the Industrial Revolution took about 80 years, and we did that in March. So complete change of everything that you can think of as it applies to work. Fast forward to about 2.5 months ago, the U.S. Census put out new data to show that 7% of the U.S. workforce is currently working remotely. However, when you include hybrid, it's 32%. So we've actually not dropped off that much from our main peak of 45%. 45%, the data was probably the vast majority of those people were working completely remotely. But the big waiting room right now is hybrid work. So for anyone that's, you know, doesn't understand remote work, there's three separate categories. There is on-premise work, which is working inside of an office. There is remote work, meaning you don't go into an office at all. You might go to a co-working space, but you don't actually interact with other co-workers. And then there's hybrid, in which you go to an office and you interact with co-workers 1 to 5 days per week. And then 1 to 5 days per week, you might be working remotely. The vast majority of the market has gone hybrid. And my belief is that hybrid is actually, to a degree, the inability for people to really understand how to execute on remote work. That's probably one of the major reasons why I wrote the book. If you don't understand how to work remotely, if you've tried this remote work thing for the last couple of years and you're thinking, maybe it just doesn't really stick, this book is specifically designed to be able to help you and figure out where you got it wrong by looking at these role pioneers that are doing it right. But we're in this interesting waiting room, and I think within the next 24 months, hybrid will actually compress pretty heavily, where we're going to see people either go completely back to the office or completely remote. And I think hybrid will end up being probably about 20% of the working relationships in place, and then hybrid and on-premise will result for the other 80%.
Interesting, Liam. And Liam, I have to say, I'm really conflicted on the topic of remote and hybrid, right? And if I can explain it in this respect. So when we and I co-founded our business, CXC in EMEA, back in 2015, we were remote first from word one, day one. Now, part of that was economic. When you're remote, you don't need physical offices, right? So it reduces your capital and operational expenditure. So that was a huge tick for a cash-hungry scale-up and startup at the time. And what we found then was that we were able to recruit really high-caliber people from anywhere in the world, but typically Europe, just for time zone management and differences. So we could get the best people from the UK, which is pretty close to Ireland, as you know, but also from Netherlands, Germany, Poland, and then down into India, where the time difference is much greater, maybe 5 hours ahead. And it really allowed our business to grow, because we didn't have that high cost baggage. You know, our greatest cost wasn't office, wasn't, you know, shiny buildings in downtown London or downtown Dublin, although we did have that on occasion, I must admit. But we soon jettisoned them because they did not work for us, right? And we were much more comfortable having hubs, right? So for our organization, and I know many, remote works, right? And we get together, we have away days, and you know, but they're not as glamorous as Bali or anywhere like that, right? But you know, we get together and we have a really good time, where work isn't what's discussed. It's more social, right? And it's really effective, and we've been able to build this culture that is difficult to describe, but just works, right? It's efficient, effective, autonomous. People feel empowered, people feel respected, we communicate well, I think, and all the feedback suggests that, right? But then I go on LinkedIn every day. It's a great sales and brand building tool, as we're all aware and our listeners are. And I see this debate, and the debate is basically you're either for remote working or you're against it, right? And if you're against it, you're some sort of Luddite Neanderthal, right? And I guess that's where I'm conflicted, because what's so wrong with hybrid? What's so wrong with going into an office occasionally or once a week? Whoa. Mm-hmm. What's the problem with that in short? I'm not saying you have a problem with it, Liam, but just, you know, the received wisdom and the discourse out there. Why does it have to be so almost black and white? Surely there's some sort of middle ground to be explored here. What's your
take? Oh, yeah. Well, I think you've encountered the remote work fundamentalists. So, yes, the ones that are, you know, give me death or give me remote work. And to be honest with you, those groups of people, which I actually say they're a very vocal minority, to be honest with you, of the entire community, they're the ones that are accelerating business owners back to the office, because they're recognizing, they're saying, oh, complete freedom. Listen, you need to not do any measurement whatsoever of your workers. You just need to completely let them sit out in the ether, and whatever comes back into your organization, hey, you know what? It'll just happen. It'll just happen automatically. It does not. That doesn't work. You know, I can't remember who coined the phrase. Maybe it was Peter Drucker. What doesn't get measured doesn't get managed. You need to measure everything. And that's why actually the third core tenet of the book is detailed metrics, right? Deliberate over communication, democratized workflows, and detailed metrics. Those are the three core tenets of remote work. You need to measure as much as you possibly can in order to have a successful organization. We have every single team members inside of the organization has a longitudinal quantifiable metric that they are measured by. So we're a merit-based organization. Really, at the core, we are a meritocracy. So it doesn't matter what your job role was before you came into the company. You have to prove yourself on your merits inside of this organization. And that's what you're measured by. Now, hybrid, just to kind of speak on the other side of it, one of the major issues with hybrid is what I call distance bias and also charisma bias. So distance bias is if you have a worker that is working remotely versus a worker that's working inside of the office and the decision maker is inside of the office, inevitably the manager biases themselves to the person that's closer to them, that they have more face time with. And this is a real problematic issue. So one of the suggestions that I would make for people is if you're going to proceed with hybrid, then what I would do, which I know is very difficult for a lot of people, is try to make sure that your decision makers, your managers, your leaders actually remove themselves as much as possible from that environment, because then they could divide themselves where everyone is equal, as opposed to the undocumented conversations, which we talk a lot about in the book. So synchronous organizations have a lot of undocumented conversations, which is, let's say that there's 8 people in a meeting, there's 3 people on Zoom, and there's 5 people in the boardroom. When the 3 people pop off of Zoom, there's another conversation that happens. And it's usually the juicier one, and it's usually the one that ends up getting things done, unfortunately. And it's usually throwing those other 3 people that were just on Zoom under the bus. And so because of that, that creates a really negative feedback loop where those remote workers are really second-class citizens. They either have to go into the office in order to be able to be more effective in their jobs, or they find another job. What we're seeing right now with the Great Resignation and quiet quitting is the majority of those people are actually just completely becoming completely disengaged from the process, and or they're finding a job somewhere else. So it's definitely multifaceted. You need to be able to work on all of those different aspects to be able to make it work. It's not easy, right? It's not a magic pill. However, grand scheme of things, when you think about a remote organization such as ourselves, we have team members in 40 different countries all over the world. It creates an environment where you can hire talent wherever you want on planet Earth. You can have access to that talent. They have the autonomy to be able to do the work that they want to do, because I don't necessarily have to do 3 hours of Zoom calls with them every single day in order for them to be successful inside of that particular position. And once you've built that type of framework in place, you can scale your company much faster than a synchronous model.
Yeah, I agree actually, Liam, with a lot of your comments there. And the other, I'm just thinking about some of the positive benefits of being fully remote. I think, at least in our organization, the day-to-day petty politics seem to have gone. You know, it doesn't seem to be that sort of culture. I'm sure there is in some areas. We haven't experienced it yet, and maybe as we continue to grow our business, that will come. But we haven't seen that backbiting. But I always use this analogy. Do you ever remember being in a physical office and there might be a shared microwave where people heat up their food, and someone might have fish in their pasta and they heat it up in the microwave and it stinks, or someone takes the coffee cup or they don't replace the filter coffee, they don't pour it in, and all those petty aggressions can actually create a rather toxic working environment, because, you know, people at their core are generally territorial, right? They don't want someone to sit where they sit previously. They don't want someone to use their cup. I think remote working, when done pure, can just get rid of all that shit. Would you agree?
I agree. I think that, as I said before, it really just boils down to a pure meritocracy. What are the numbers? Are you doing well? Are you doing okay, or are you doing badly? We have green, yellow, red. And this is generally from like entrepreneur operating system, bunch of other frameworks. Where I'm not, you know, we're literally just using that type of framework and implementing it inside of remote teams. But fundamentally, are you doing good at your job? You can very clearly identify that, as opposed to the second aspect, which is really problematic, which you've actually touched on. I call it charisma bias inside of organizations. So if you look at a board meeting, boardroom, and you have 8 people in there, and you're not even hearing what's going on, you can probably figure out whose ideas are going to get adopted the most. It's the 6'5" white male guy that looks like Captain America. That's usually the guy that ends up having his ideas adopted the vast majority of the time in comparison to other people. Like me, I don't really have that skill set to be able to communicate charismatically and argue my point in the moment. However, through text form, through asynchronous form, I can convince people to a much higher degree. Now, does Captain America have better ideas than everyone else? No. If anything, actually, because he's had to get so good at being charismatic, his ideas may be worse than everyone else's. But because he has this leadership mindset and he's able to drive people towards a goal, people adopt his ideas a lot more often. So I believe, and the data is, I mean, I don't have the core data sets on this, but I believe that asynchronous organizations, because ideas are not adopted by who is the most charismatic, but by who has the best ideas, I think more ideas are adopted, more good ideas are adopted more often inside of asynchronous organizations than in on-premise organizations, which is a huge advantage. And it boils into the, hey, I'm heating, you know, I'm microwaving my fish in the, you know, in the microwave, and no one really likes that. And those kind of negative components pull into a conversation where maybe you've got a problem with me because I microwaved my fish yesterday, but I'm really presenting a fantastic idea. Yes. But you don't want to listen to that because of the drama of the fish microwaving yesterday.
Yeah, I'm with you, Liam. And Liam, I just want to touch on something because I've been thinking about this a lot recently around that second tier society or that second class citizen. But I've been looking at it from a slightly different perspective, which is, as best as I can tell, a lot of the remote workers are knowledge-based workers. They've got a desk, a computer, a laptop, whatever the hell, a device, right? They can often sit at home. They oftentimes have got higher paid jobs than, you know, the bin man or the garbage woman, right? That don't have a desk and are referred to as deskless workers. And I think out of the global working population, there's about 80%, according to statistics from the researcher Anita Letting, that 80% of the world's working population are deskless, right? Whereby they actually are on the front line somewhere, if you like to use that dreaded phrase. They're in a restaurant, a coffee shop, a garbage refuge factory, a manufacturing facility, whatnot. Aren't we in danger as this remote working trend continues that we're really creating a two-tier society between those that have a desk and those that don't?
Yeah, for sure. if you work remotely, there's a 4 times higher chance that you make more than $100,000 a year in comparison to if you don't work remotely. There is a huge division between remote and non-remote. With that said, however, those are unfortunately market forces. And for me, because I'm a hardcore capitalist, I think a lot about just the reality. Capitalism, someone gave me the best definition of capitalism, which is capitalism allows for the existence of evil to be added into the formula. And the perspective that we can't turn away from that there is someone that needs to, quote unquote, dig the ditches to be able to, you know, serve the coffee, to be able to pump the gas. Well, maybe not to pump the gas, but that reality is inevitable. And I think actually for people that are in the market right now, you really have to ask yourself, do you want to be someone who has a desk or do you not? Because I think regardless of our control over that, that is going to happen. That is an inevitability. So you really have to say to yourself, which direction do I want to choose? Because I think it is going to be a very dualistic society. I think there's going to be, and we're already seeing it now, there is a culture of people that are saying, I'm going to work from home or I'm not going to work in this company. And because their talent is in high demand, they get that. If you are and I think actually a really good example of this is customer support agents. So the number one job that has a desk on planet Earth is customer support rep. That is the number one job. And so when you think about that, that is a low-skilled job that is very replaceable. And it's difficult for those people to be able to work remotely at this point, because it's just that that labor is not in demand as much, because they are very easily replaceable. You know, it's like a, I can't remember what the, it's like a small white collar job. I can't remember what they call it, but it's basically a replaceable, it's a low barrier to entry white collar job. So when you think about those types of jobs, they are definitely going to be, and they are still remote. Most customer support reps now, I think the latest numbers that I saw were about 40% of them are remote or hybrid in some context. So it's a very large block, right? But I think that you're going to see a huge shift probably in the next... It's happening now, but I think it will be complete within about 36 months, where you're going to see the haves and the haves not. And I think one of the major differentiators will be, can I work remotely or can I not?
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment. And listen, I'm a capitalist too, but I'm always thinking about how can we help better level up, right? And it strikes me that remote working and the ability to work anywhere for any company within reason, remote work really makes that possible, right? It allows people potentially in other countries to access opportunities that they wouldn't necessarily be able to access in the old physical way of working, where you had to be on premise, on site, you had to be a citizen of the United States or Canada or UK. Remote working done well, particularly in technology organizations and other organizations that are service or consulting based, it strikes me, and I'd love to hear your view, Liam, that there's a potential opportunity to use remote work for the good and the good of others that might not necessarily be in our own countries and locations. What's your hot take on that, Liam?
Yeah, so my perspective is that remote work gives employers and employees the opportunity to find the best of each other. And that's a really fantastic achievement for human civilization. At no other point in history have we been able to say, oh, I don't want to just find the best person in Dublin. I want to find the best person on planet Earth. And so because of that, we're actually going to have many more employees that are going to be able to get jobs that they enjoy significantly more. This is actually one of the first couple iterations of the internet back in the 90s. A lot of the, when we move from Web 1.0 to Web 2.0, and we're currently entering Web 3.0, Web 2.0 was user-generated content. And that's when everything really changed, where if you were someone that really liked Legos from the 1980s, as an example, there could be a group that you could interact with. You could find a tribe of other people that liked 1980s Legos. And you could hang out with that group. You could go to meetups with that group. You could talk online with that group. There were Facebook groups. There were online forums. And so today, I think we're actually going to see that same level of specificity with regards to remote work. So people are going to get very, very specific at their jobs. It's what I like to call the portfolio technique. I'm going to be good at a very small amount of things, because now that really create passion for me, because now there are the opportunities out there, because the job opportunities are global. They're not necessarily national or provincial or municipal. And so because of that, I think it's a really exciting time for the future of work. But when I think about all the opportunities of people that have really taken this to heart, the biggest one, and we actually commit this in the book, he's the third person that I thank in the book, is Fahim. And if you just Google Fahim running remote, you should be able to find this. We did a short with Fahim about 4 years ago in combination with Fiverr and Facebook and a bunch of other companies, where this man was, he became a graphics designer. So him and his mother were selling blankets in Dhaka in Bangladesh. And if you've ever been to Dhaka before, no offense towards people that are currently in Dhaka, it's one of the worst cities on planet Earth. It's very, very difficult. It's one of the poorest cities on planet Earth. He was selling these blankets on planet Earth. He got enough money together in order to be able to get himself a computer. And he bought some 4G internet access. And with that money, he was able to self-train himself on graphics design. And he went from going to a dollar a day to making thousands and thousands of dollars per month as a graphics designer, and actually became a top 10 designer on Upwork and Fiverr and all of these other platforms. And the thing that people don't know about Fahim is that he has muscular dystrophy. He can only move his hand. So if you applied, if Fahim applied to any particular job in person and you had someone that was rolling in their wheelchair and could only move their hand and said, I want to become a graphics designer, regardless of how egalitarian you want to be, your bias would be very, very clear. That person would not get a job. But because remote work removes those biases, it removes the wrapper, it allows you to just have the numbers, the merit of the work being presented, Fahim was able to become incredibly successful as a graphics designer. And unfortunately, Fahim, like a lot of people, we ended up losing him during COVID. He ended up getting COVID and he died of it about a year and a half ago. But still an incredibly inspirational person. When that short went live, it just went viral. Millions and millions of views. And he had his government that was, you know, trying to run a program with him to be able to encourage other people to be able to get access to these types of labor opportunities. So think about that when you think about work opportunities and how you can just remove all of those barriers, because Fahim is the perfect example, the epitome of what I think remote work is really looking for, is really kind of providing to people that are not in Western countries that have MacBook Pros.
Well, I tell you, Liam, that's a bloody good, sad story if the two can coexist. But I think it gives a striking example of the good that remote work can and has done, and I hope will continue to do as well. Having read your book, right, I consider myself reasonably switched on, but a lot of our audience, I'm sure, have noticed terms such as async, democratized workflows. You know, if you go to the Oxford English Dictionary and look up asynchronous, right, you'll have the dictionary definition of that, of course, but I don't think that really cuts it when it comes to describing asynchronous in the world of remote work. So would you mind just giving our audience and myself an overview of what asynchronous, or async as it's more commonly described, as work or work arrangements are?
Sure. I'll pull it right out of the book, actually.
This is what I love. Having the author on the bloody show to do this.
Yeah. Thing. So I actually think we need to focus more specifically on asynchronous management, because there's asynchronous work, which is the ability to be able to work with people without simultaneously interacting with them. Meaning we have team members in 40 different countries all over the world. It's impossible for us to be able to interact with those people synchronously. So we interact with them asynchronously, which is effectively the process of management. So that's the practice of leading individuals or teams without simultaneous or synchronous communication. All collaboration and information are funneled through online systems. Work focuses on individual autonomy, allowing all team members to maximize their own productivity without being dependent upon others to complete a task or provide updates. And that's the big piece of it. So think of it almost in the context of, and it's very difficult for people to get their heads around, what if there was no immediacy inside of an organization? So there was no, we need to talk about this now. That doesn't exist inside of asynchronous organizations. You can communicate that information, but it is detrimental to interrupt other people's flow state, other people's, what we mention a lot in the book, my friend Cal Newport, who was a fantastic, he actually gave us a fantastic blurb at the front of our book. He's written an incredibly successful framework for work called deep work. And deep work is effectively the process by which you have everything in front of you to be able to accomplish a difficult task. And so the more that you can optimize your workforce for deep work, the more the higher percentage of their workday that they can focus on deep work, the more successful your organization is going to be. If everyone knows what they need to do and they have everything available to them in order to actually execute on what they need to do, and then they do it, you're going to have a much faster moving organization than anyone else. And so when I think about asynchronous work, it is getting in front of people and allowing for them to not be distracted by effectively, unfortunately, the manager that is saying, we need to meet right now to discuss this particular issue because this issue is really important. The vast majority of the time, that issue is not important, and it can wait until that worker checks their project management system, checks their email, and is able to respond to it when it is most opportunistic for them, when they are the most productive in order to be able to respond to that particular problem. So that's kind of the crux of it, which is if you remove immediacy from the organization, then you create an environment where, and even though you think you're moving faster in the moment, and you absolutely are. So this is the thing that I think is very difficult for people to get their heads around. If I say, hey, there's an emergency and we need to talk about this right now. Yes, we solved that problem for right now and we got it solved faster than if I had done it asynchronously. But on an organizational level, if you do that 50 times a day for a company of 200 people, the amount of work that they can actually get done significantly minimizes itself. The amount of deep work that you do in the organization goes down. And that means, yes, I've solved this small little pebble issue that we need to be able to address today, but I've done it at the expense of the rock that I need to accomplish for the quarter or for the year. And so that's the issue. And it's still something that I'm currently still doing a study with about a dozen companies that are synchronous, and I'm trying to move them asynchronous. And that is the biggest barrier to entry right now, is removing that culture of immediacy inside of the organization, because it comes at the detriment of your overall rocks. What do you really want to accomplish? You know, do you really want to build that integration API, which is something that we're dealing with right now? Well, then take your engineers, leave them alone. They know exactly what to do, and do not bother them under any circumstances whatsoever. If you do that, you will ship that feature faster. If you're constantly asking them for updates, you will not ship that feature faster. It will happen slower.
Wow. I tell you, Liam, that's the best explanation I've heard for async management, right? Not async work. And that's really clear to me, the benefits of it. And, you know, I think about some of the team that work with me, and now I work with them, and we work with each other. You know, it could be a cultural change to remove that immediacy, but I can see the absolute benefit of that approach. So thank you very much for sharing that with me and sharing that with our audience, Liam. Liam, before we bring our conversation to a close, I'd like to ask you a question that we ask all of our audience, which is a relatively simple question. The answer might not be, but what is your vision, if any, for the future of work?
I think within the next 10 years, half in the S&P 500 will be remote. That's my vision for remote work. I think that once people recognize that there is an operating system for remote work, it's not just recreating the office, but it's a different way of working. Once they get that critical issue solved or understood, remote work will proliferate, because as I think in the first chapter of the book, we talk with Darren Murph, who is the head of remote at GitLab. Yeah.
Yes.
And Darren said, this is really a Model T moment. So I don't know if you know this. It's a very kind of interesting factoid. The highest population of horses on planet Earth was 1915, which is also just happened to be the very first year that the first Model T rolled off the production line. I think we're in this moment right now. I think 2022 is that year where you're going to see there's a better way to work. There's a methodology that you have to apply to it, but fundamentally it's a better way to work. And once companies recognize that, regardless of whether or not they like that working environment, and I think the vast majority do, but or whether employees like it or employers like it, it inevitably will be a more efficient model. It will be a more efficient way to be able to extract value out of organizations. And because of that, I think that it is an inevitability that more and more organizations will adopt remote work at scale. And you're going to see, as I said before, half the S&P 500 probably working remotely within the next decade.
Wow. I think exciting times are ahead. And I think that's a very specific prediction and a really nice way to close our conversation. Liam, I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. I thoroughly enjoyed our book. I've really enjoyed digging into some of the topics that you discussed in your book in more detail. Where is the best place for our audience to find and buy your book and reach out to you?
So runningremotebook.com is probably the best place to be able to check out everything connected to the book. You can obviously go to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all of the major book chains carries the book. But if we're going to be completely honest with you, since we work remotely, Amazon is really the best place to be able to deliver it. And and no offense to Barnes & Noble, the publisher, by the way, has always been saying you need to include Barnes & Noble every one of your table reads. So outside of that, I think you can also go to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/runningremote. All of our talks are up there for free. So if you can't afford the book or if you can't afford a ticket to Running Remote, go check out the YouTube channel. The content's up there for free. And if you want to get a masterclass in remote work, it's there.
Wonderful. Liam, we'll link your YouTube channel in the show notes and also link to Amazon where our audience can purchase the book. But Liam, thoroughly enjoy your time. Thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. Wishing you a great day. Thanks so much for getting up early to do the show. And it's so good to connect. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks for having me.